of seeking from others. He says, asking others has certain negative consequences, the first of which is it makes a person weak. It weakens the speech of the person. يُضْعِفُ لِسَانَ الْمُتَكَلِّمِ The speaker who is asking for something, that person cannot speak with confidence. He trembles. He is scared as he begs because he knows that one wrong word from him would remove any hope of attaining what he seeks from the person whom he is asking. So he is asking with a lot of fear, and this weakens him. The second is وَيَكْسِرُ قَلْبَ الشُّجَاعِ الْبَطَلِ When a person is even courageous and heroic, still when he has to ask somebody for something, then it breaks his heart, because now you are lowering yourself in front of someone else. You are putting yourself in a position where someone else is higher than you. So even if you are a courageous and heroic individual, still, the moment you have to ask for something, you have to beg for something, then you are breaking your heart and you are breaking that courage that you have within you. That is the second negative consequence. The third is وَيُوقِفُ الْحُرَّ الْعَزِيزِ مَوْقِفَ الْعَبْدِ الذَّلِيلِ It turns the respected free person into one who is like an abased slave, one who is like a lowly slave. So, you know, obviously in the society at the time of the Prophet and the A'imma alayhim as-salam, people were of two kinds. There were free people and there were slaves. The slaves were those who had no volition and they had no choice in the way they lived their lives. They had to live as their masters dictated to them. And so a slave was somebody who had no control over his own destiny, over his own life. And many times, therefore, slaves yearned for freedom and they tried in different ways to earn their freedom. And so once a slave was freed, that was the biggest achievement he or she could attain in their life. So freedom has great value. The Imam alayhi salam says that when you beg from someone, when you ask someone for assistance, then you, even if you are a free person with your own dignity and respect, the moment you beg, the moment you ask, you turn into someone who is like a slave, a lowly slave. Because now you have put yourself in a position where someone else has power over you. That person can either give you what you need or can deprive you and leave you suffering as you are. And so this is the third negative consequence of begging or asking. The fourth is وَيُذْهِبُ بَهَاءَ الْوَجْهِ And when you beg, when you ask, the dignity that you have dissipates. Now you no longer have any respect or dignity because you are degrading yourself by asking someone else. And finally, وَيَمْحَقُ الرِّزْقِ When you ask, you lose your sustenance. A person who begs others loses his rizq. His rizq, his sustenance becomes less. It reduces. Why? Because one of the ways of increasing one's sustenance is by depending solely upon Allah Azza wa Jal, by having faith and trust in Allah Azza wa Jal. When you have trust in Allah, the Quran also says, وَمَن يَتَوَكَّلَ عَلَى اللَّهِ فَهُوَ حَسْبُهُ Whoever has complete trust in Allah, Allah is sufficient for that person. But now when you put your trust and your dependence on someone else, then your sustenance reduces. So these are the negative consequences of asking. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal to grant us the ability to avoid asking others. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity by Brother Taher Reza Jafar. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadun Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is His messenger.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Lecture. Sheikh Taher Reza Jafar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Faqad qala Amirul Mu'minin alayhi salam fi khutbatin lahu. ولو أراد الله أن يخلق آدم من نور يخطف الأبصار ضياؤه ويبهر العقول رواؤه وطيب يأخذ الأنفاس عرفه لفعل ولو فعل لظلت له الأعناق خاضعة ولخفت البلوى فيه على الملائكة ولكن الله سبحانه يبتلي خلقه ببعض ما يجهلون أصله تمييزا بالاختبار لهم ونفيا للاستكبار عنهم وإبعادا للخيلاء منهم فاعتبروا بما كان من فعل الله بإبليس إذ أحبط عمله الطويل وجهده الجهيد وكان قد عبد الله 6,000 سنة لا يدرى أمن سن الدنيا أم من سن الآخرة عن كبر ساعة واحدة فمن ذا بعد إبليس يسلم على الله بمثل معصيته كلا ما كان الله سبحانه ليدخل الجنة بشرا بأمر أخرج به منها ملكا إن حكمه في أهل السماء وأهل الأرض لواحد وما بين الله وبين أحد من خلقه هوادة في إباحة حمن حرمه على العالمين صلوات على محمد وآل محمد
Now again, we take out
some themes from this khutbah, this part of the khutbah, and we discuss in more detail. The first theme that we want to take out from this part of the khutbah al-qasi'ah is the issue of Allah Azza wa Jal testing us through things that are unknown to us, the reality of which is unknown to us. And He does that with all His creatures. When He created Adam, as we mentioned yesterday, the malaika, out of their curiosity, they asked, "O Allah, why are you creating this creature when we are doing tasbih, when we are glorifying you? Why have you to create a creature out of clay through whose qualities already we know he is going to be a person who does a lot of fasad, corruption, bloodshed on earth?" And then Allah Azza wa Jal, in response to the malaika, He teaches Adam alayhi salam some names. And then He tells the angels, "Do you know these names?" And they reply, "Subhanaka la ilma lana illa ma 'allamtana innaka antal 'alimul hakim." O Allah, glory be to you. We don't know anything but that which you have taught us. Indeed, you are the most knowing, the most wise. So Allah Azza wa Jal then tells Adam, "Now tell them about the names." And when Adam alayhi salam tells the malaika about the names, then they realize that indeed there was something in this creature that is special. That is why Allah Azza wa Jal created it in a manner that He wanted us to prostrate before this creature. So the test was when the malaika did not know, they had to do the sajda. Then later Allah informed them about the value of the human being. Now when we look at this idea, we find in the Quran we have different examples. The famous story of Prophet Musa alayhi salam and Nabi Khidr in Surah Al-Kahf. We have all heard about this story of how when Nabi Musa alayhi salam goes and he meets Nabi Khidr alayhi salam, although the Quran does not take the name of Khidr, it says Abdan min ibadina. He was one of our servants. But the Mufassirin say it was Khidr alayhi salam. And he wanted to accompany Nabi Khidr. And Nabi Khidr said, "Look, you cannot accompany me because what you will see me doing, you do not have the patience to bear." But Nabi Musa alayhi salam insisted. He said, "Let me come with you." And so Nabi Khidr allowed him on the condition that you remain silent and don't ask me anything until I myself reveal it to you. And so they go, and then you know the story very well, and they find a boat, which Nabi Khidr then proceeds to make a hole in the boat and sink that boat. And immediately Nabi Musa alayhi salam asks the question, "How can you sink this boat? It belongs to poor people, poor fishermen. What an evil deed you are doing. Why are you doing it?" And immediately Nabi Khidr reminds him, "Did I not tell you, you will not have the patience?" And so Nabi Musa says, "Give me a second chance." And they continue. And then Nabi Khidr kills a young boy. At that time, again, Musa alayhi salam could not control himself. "You are killing an innocent child, ma'soom. Why?" Nabi Khidr says, "Did I not tell you, you don't have the patience?" "One more chance," Nabi Musa alayhi salam says. "One more chance on the condition if I ask you the third time, I myself will leave your presence." Nabi Khidr said, "Okay, one more chance." They continue. They come to a city where the people of that city are so evil and so bad that even when they ask for something simple as water and some food and a place to rest, they are not allowed to enter that city. They are not given hospitality. They are not hosted by those people. And in that city, they see a wall is about to fall. And Nabi Khidr starts building the wall and he tells Musa alayhi salam, "Come help me, let's build this wall." And Nabi Musa alayhi salam again could bear it no longer. And he said, "Why? These people are so bad. They are so evil. They are not kind at all. They have given us nothing. You want to build this wall?" And then Nabi Khidr proceeds to give Nabi Musa alayhi salam the reasoning behind these three actions before they part ways. And we all know, we have read this in the Quran, it is very clear. Nabi Khidr tells Nabi Musa alayhi salam that I made the hole in the boat because there was a king who was coming to take all these boats, ghasb, take all these boats, and I wanted this boat to be saved because now they will be able to salvage it. So I made the hole purposely on this boat. I killed the child because Allah Azza wa Jal wants to give his parents one who is better than him. He will grow up to be a child who hurts the feelings of his parents. His parents are believers. So the command came and I had to kill this child. And then the third thing, he said that the wall we have built is because under this wall there is a treasure that belongs to orphans. And you saw how bad the people of this city were. If we had left it to fall, they would have usurped and taken all the treasure that belonged to the orphans. And that is what happened when it came to one of the prophets of Allah Azza wa Jal. The test comes when you don't know the hikmah behind certain things. That does not mean that there is no wisdom. Many times we look at what is happening in the world and we ask ourselves, you see a tsunami coming somewhere, you see some natural disasters in one part of the world or another, and you ask, so many people died. Where is the justice of Allah? Where is the rahmah of Allah? This is because you do not know. The problem is not with the rahmah of Allah. The problem is not with the justice of Allah. It is because you do not know it. But when the day of Qiyamah comes and you will see, you will realize indeed in this catastrophe there was the rahmah and mercy of Allah Azza wa Jal. There was justice of Allah Azza wa Jal. And so this is how Allah tests His creatures. بِبَعْضِ مَا يَجْهَلُونَ أَصْلَهُ, by that which they do not understand. And that is why they say one of the explanations of isma. When you talk about isma, ma'asum, who is a ma'asum? One who is safe from sinning, who does not sin. Why do they not sin? Are they incapable of sinning? They don't have the ability to sin? If you say that somebody does not have the ability to sin and then does not sin, there is no fadila in that. There is no greatness in that. Because they don't have the ability. No, we say they have the ability, but they never sin. Why? Because they can see the reality of sin. They can see the real consequence of sin. And so they keep away from it. Whereas we cannot see the real consequence, and that is why sometimes we go towards the sin. That is one explanation of isma. So the first theme therefore is that Allah Azza wa Jal tests us with things that we have no knowledge of. And inshallah, when we die and we are resurrected, we will realize all the things that have happened in this world, and you will find it is all rahmah, it is all beauty. There is nothing evil, there is nothing that is something that is outside the realm of the beautiful creation of Allah Azza wa Jal. But it is something we don't realize at the moment. That is the first thing. The second point that we want to talk about is regarding worship. We saw that Shaitan worshipped Allah for 6,000 years. Many of us, if we worship Allah Azza wa Jal for a short period of time, we start feeling good about it. We feel so happy with ourselves. A person has fasted for 3 months instead of one. He fasted in Rajab, Sha'ban and Shahr Ramadan. He is so happy with himself, mashallah. Look at me, I'm such a good mu'min. The reality, however, is that your worship has no value and you will never be able to repay Allah Azza wa Jal even for a single ni'mah by all your worship. All your worship is not sufficient To repay Allah Azza wa Jal for a single ni'mah, a single breath you breathe in and breathe out, you cannot recompense Allah Azza wa Jal for that. And so, there is no point in feeling great about your worship. And that is why when we come on the Day of Judgment, our hope is that Allah will give us Jannah through His grace and mercy, not through our worship. We recite in dua, Rabbi aamilna bifadlik, wa la tu'amilna bi'adlik. Oh Allah, count our deeds with your grace and your mercy, not with your justice. Because if you account for our deeds with your justice, we won't deserve your Jannah. We won't deserve your mercy. So here Shaitan worshipped Allah for 6,000 years. Was it the years of the dunya or the akhirah? We don't know. And now, in one instance, it is all nullified. The nullification of deeds is known as ihbatul a'mal. Your deeds are nullified. Question: how can it be that somebody worships for so many years and in one instance it is all nullified? How is it possible? Sheikh Makarim Shirazi has a very beautiful answer. He says it is very logical. To build a building takes how many years? But to destroy it, how long does it take? If you burn it, if you put dynamite, in an instant that whole building that probably took a year, 2 years, 3 years, I know these days they build very quickly, but in the past sometimes it would take 10 years for one building. And so if a person does ibadah and ibadah and ibadah, in a single instance it is possible that all that is nullified, the way it happened for shaitan. And ihbatul a'mal is something that we find in the Quran. It is a Quranic concept. In the Holy Quran, Allah Azza wa Jal mentions it in so many different places. حَبِطَتْ أَعْمَالُهُمْ. Their actions were nullified for different reasons. Why is our actions nullified? Why are they nullified? What can cause your actions to be nullified? We will mention 5 things. There could be more. Number one is disbelief in Allah Azza wa Jal. If you disbelieve in Allah, your deeds are nullified. Surah Al-A'raf, verse 147, Allah Azza wa Jal says, وَالَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا بِآيَاتِنَا وَلِقَاءِ الْآخِرَةِ حَبِطَتْ أَعْمَالُهُمْ. Those who disbelieve in our signs and in the meeting of the Akhirah, that they will meet us in the Akhirah, their a'mal are nullified. That's number one, disbelief in Allah. Number two, hypocrisy. In Surah Al-Ahzab, verse 19, we are told about some people who did things that they were pretending to be Muslims, but they went against the Muslims. Allah Azza wa Jal says, أُولَٰئِكَ لَمْ يُؤْمِنُوا فَأَحْبَطَ اللَّهُ أَعْمَالَهُمْ. These people were not truly believers, so Allah nullified their deeds. All their a'mal were nullified. Number three, disrespecting Rasulullah Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. If you disrespect Rasulullah, your deeds are nullified. Surah Al-Hujurat, verse number 2, Allah Azza wa Jal says, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, la tarfa'u aswatakum fawqa sawti an-nabi, وَلَا تَجْهَرُوا لَهُ بِالْقَوْلِ كَجَهْرِ بَعْضِكُمْ لِبَعْضٍ أَنْ تَحْبَطَ أَعْمَالَكُمْ وَأَنْتُمْ لَا تَشْعُرُونَ. O people, O believers, when you address the Prophet, do not raise your voice in his presence. And do not talk to him the way you talk to one another. When you want to talk to Rasulullah, lower your voice and talk to Rasulullah. Your communication with him should not be like your communication with anyone else. He has a special respect. If you don't listen and you don't follow these instructions, your deeds will be nullified. وَأَنْتُمْ لَا تَشْعُرُونَ. And you won't even know about it. When you die, then you will come to know. So the third reason why your deeds are nullified is disrespecting Rasulullah. And by extension, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. It's very important. Of course, then we have other reasons. If people perform actions for the wrong reasons, to show off to others, for riya, to try and get a reputation, a good reputation in the community, they are not doing it for Allah Azza wa Jal, obviously then those actions are nullified. They don't get the reward for it because they are not doing it for Allah Azza wa Jal. And there is one very interesting hadith also that talks about this. And in that hadith we are told that even when a person does not have sabr in musibah, he nullifies the reward for that musibah, for that hardship. A riwayah from Rasulullah Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he talks about ضَرْبُ الرَّجُلِ يَدَهُ عَلَىٰ فَخِذِهِ عِنْدَ الْمُصِيبَةِ إِحْبَاطٌ لِأَجْرِهِ. When a man hits his hand on his thigh during musibah, during hardship, meaning he loses his patience, he loses his patience, then he nullifies the reward for that musibah. You know, whenever musibah and hardship come on you, whenever in your life you face any difficulty, if you bear that difficulty with patience, you get thawab for it. Just for bearing the difficulty, just for bearing the musibah, you get reward. But if you do not bear it with patience, you lose that reward. So this is another example of ihbatul a'mal. So in an instance, a person can lose years worth of worship in one single instance. It is so important for us to realize that every moment of our lives can have life-changing effects for us. A single moment, you lose all your good deeds. Similarly, a single moment is enough to bring somebody from misguidance into guidance. A single moment is enough to make somebody from a sinner to a mu'min, a good, devout believer. A single moment. They call it an epiphany. You have an epiphany, now you are no longer a sinner. Something has woken up in your soul, in your heart. And we have three beautiful examples from the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. Example number one, Bishr al-Hafi. How when the Imam is passing by his house and he hears music playing, and he asks the servant girl, who is the owner of this house? Is he a free man or a slave? And she says, he's a free man. And the Imam alayhi salam says, yes, he must be a free man. Because if he was a slave of Allah azza wa jal, he would not be doing this. And so she goes back, and when Bishr asks her, why are you late? She recounts her conversation with Imam alayhi salam. Immediately, that was enough to awaken in him that sense of remorse. He ran after the Imam without his sandals. Hafi means barefoot. Bishr al-Hafi, Bishr the barefooted one. He goes to Imam, he asks, can I do tawbah? The Imam says, the doors of tawbah are open, but tawbah comes with conditions. And Bishr accepts, and from that day onwards, he never wore slippers till the day he died. But the beautiful thing was that that epiphany, that waking up of his soul, continued after he died as well, because he had three daughters, and all three of them were zuhad, were abstemious, were people who devoted their lives to Allah Azza wa Jalla. One single instance, one single sentence changed not only the life of Bishr but also his daughters. Another example from the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, where Harun wanted to defame Imam al-Kadhim, and Imam was in the prison cell, in the dungeon. And so Harun, in order to defame the Imam, he sends a beautiful slave girl to the Imam while the Imam was in the prison. After some time, he sends his servant to go and see what had happened to the slave girl. The servant goes and he sees that she is in sajda and reciting, Quddusun, Quddusun, Subhanallah, Subhanallah. And she's not moving. And he goes back and reports to Harun, Harun, the slave girl you sent, I saw her in this state. She's in sajda. He said, go and call her. He goes and he brings the slave girl back to Harun. And Harun asks her, what happened? She said, this is what I saw Abdul Salih doing. This is what I saw the Imam doing. It changed her. It changed. Until the day she died. And the beauty of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he had this personality that just by looking at him, people would change. You know, the person who was responsible for poisoning Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, his name was Sindi bin Shahik, very hard-hearted man. It is said that Imam al-Kadhim was kept as a prisoner in Sindi's house for some time. Under house arrest in Sindi's house. Just by seeing the Imam, Sindi bin Shahik's son, whose name was Hussein, changed. Just by seeing the Imam, he changed and he was guided and he became one of the greatest poets who recited poems in praise of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So in an instance, a person can change. In a single moment, you can lose all your a'mal. In a single moment, you can gain hidayah. This is very important for us to realize. So the second point is that we should not be proud of our worship. Our worship will take us nowhere. Our worship has to be accompanied with hope in the rahmah of Allah Azza wa Jalla, the fadl of Allah Azza wa Jalla. And the third theme now that we want to take from this part of the khutbah is what we had mentioned yesterday, continuing today, the theme of arrogance, the theme of takabbur. When the Imam alayhi salam is asking, do you think, O human being, that you will be allowed entry into Jannah, the same Jannah from which the Malak was expelled? Do you think so? No. Our sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, he says, لا يدخل الجنة من كان في قلبه مثقال ذرة من الكبر. One who has an atom's weight of kibr and pride and arrogance in his heart will not gain entry into Jannah. This is so important. And why do we have arrogance? Why are we so proud? Because we think that we are better than others. When you think you have something that makes you better than someone else. Yesterday we mentioned that in reality, human beings are of different value. Everyone does not have the same value. Some human beings are more valuable than others in the sight of Allah Azza wa Jalla. Of course, in the sight of human beings, they have reasons that are incorrect for thinking that they have more value. Wealth, children, and so on and so forth. These things don't give real value. Real value that a human being has is mentioned in the Holy Quran. Inna akramakum inda Allahi atqakum. Those who have more taqwa are more valuable in the sight of Allah Azza wa Jal, are more honored in the sight of Allah Azza wa Jal than those who don't have taqwa. Ilm, knowledge. Those who have more ilm are more valuable in the sight of Allah Azza wa Jal. Hal yastawi alladhina ya'lamuna wal ladhina la ya'lamun? Allah asks, Do you think the one who has ilm and the one who does not have ilm are the same? They're not the same. The one who has ilm has more value in the sight of Allah Azza wa Jalla. And that is why Islam has kept so much emphasis on ilm. What about jihad and sa'i? Yes, the Quran says the one who struggles and strives has more value in the eyes of Allah Azza wa Jal. وَأَنْ لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. Whatever the human being has and gains and wants and achieves, it is only through hard work. And that is why when Musa alayhi salam was conversing to Allah Azza wa Jal, we have so many beautiful traditions on the conversations that Musa alayhi salam had with Allah Azza wa Jal. In one conversation, Musa alayhi salam asked, "O Allah, who is the most hated human being in your eyes? Who is the most hated?" And in that tradition, Allah Azza wa Jal replies, "He is the person who is jifatun bil-layl, battalun bil-nahar." He is that person, at night he is like a dead corpse. That means he goes deep into sleep. And in his daytime he wastes his time doing useless activities. Battalun bil-nahar. That means a person who does not have hard work, does not do hard work, does not undertake difficult tasks, that person has no value. But those who do the hard work, who have jihad, jihad does not only mean fighting the way of Allah, it means struggling the way of Allah. بِأَمْوَالِكُمْ وَأَنفُسِكُمْ. With yourselves, with your wealth. When you strive, you have value. However, even if you have more value, you still don't have a right to be arrogant because of it. Somebody may feel that now, mashallah, I have more value. I am a scholar, for example. I am muttaqi, for example. I am very hardworking. So now I can be arrogant. No, you still cannot be arrogant. Arrogance is not allowed for anyone, whether you have value or not. The reason we brought about the discussion on value is that there are people who have more value in the eyes of Allah. But that does not allow you to be arrogant. There was a student of Arabic grammar who had just completed the hardest text of Arabic grammar. And Maulana is sitting here, he will tell you that Arabic grammar is probably one of the hardest subjects you have to study in the Hausa. Very difficult. So now this student finishes this book and he is very pleased with himself that he has completed this book of Arabic grammar. He's traveling and he embarks on a ship. Now he's seated in the ship as they are in the middle of the ocean. He strikes up a conversation with the captain of the ship. And he asks the captain, "Do you know Arabic grammar? Have you studied Arabic grammar?" The captain says, "No, I have not studied any Arabic grammar." "Oh, then you have wasted half your life," he's telling him. "You have wasted half your life." The captain didn't say anything. He put his head down. He could not say anything. After a while, a storm came in that ocean. The boat started shaking. There was a good possibility that that boat would sink. Everyone was frightened. At that moment, the captain comes to this very same man and he asks him, "Have you learned how to swim?" He says, "No, I haven't learned how to swim." He said, "Then you have wasted your whole life." Pride and arrogance is not allowed, whether you have some fadila, some achievement or not. And indeed, when you look at insan, as we mentioned yesterday, there is no justification for insan to be proud. Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, he said, "Ajibtu libn Adam." I'm surprised at this human being. Awwaluhu nutfa. His beginning is a drop of semen. Wa akhiruhu jifa. And his end is a corpse, a dead body. وَهُوَ قَائِمٌ بَيْنَهُمَا وِعَاءً لِلْغَائِطِ. Between these two states, he is a carrier of waste products. He is a carrier of waste products. ثُمَّ يَتَكَبَّرُ. Then he goes and he starts acting arrogant. And so human beings have no justification for arrogance. Inshallah, we will continue with the third part of this beautiful khutbah tomorrow. ربنا تقبل منا إنك أنت السميع العليم وتب علينا إنك أنت التواب الرحيم برحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين رحم الله من قرأ الفاتحة.
الله أكبر لا إله إلا الله. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochran, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
He loves the game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist.
Controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win-at-all-cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all. He
got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest lie, loser!
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed.
Yeah. I revel in your hatred, because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news, but I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe, you know, maybe he'd be a good one. It just gave me the chills.
And what about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I'd never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but has been involved in countless campaigns. But also, we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So.
Years in the making. Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure. And you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This is what was so useful about this film, was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say, this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment. And that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon. And we see this through the film. When they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump, we see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build the wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which I had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that. That whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized. And it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way, and is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment, there's been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone who's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people, the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing. His policies. He wants to cut corporation tax to record lows. Roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change. Things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're richest country in the world. Yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with and Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up, because we're about to go to him just now. So just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, when he denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea that Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and it's not, they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Yeah. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
He knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them, is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed private detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected
that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, a famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you